Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning. Steve Williamson here, and sitting across from me is Michael Costantino, and we have a great guest on radio today. Mike?
We do. We have Nancy McLean, author, been on before, might have been here before, Democracy in Chains, and I love the subtitle, The Deep History of the Political Rights Stealth Plan for America. Matter of fact, we want to jump right in and say she's going to be in town. We got a local angle here. In addition to Nancy's great, good morning, Nancy. I guess we get
good
to
morning.
Yeah,
say good morning to her, Mike. Yeah.
Just to
great
prove
to
you're
be
really
back with you.
You're really here, but
otherwise we're just talking about her.
That's true. But she's going to be here, and you can talk to her yourself. This is the title of her. I'm going to read all of this because it's so good. How the Koch brothers and the radical right are plotting to change our Constitution while Americans are distracted by tweets. It's such a perfect description, and certainly what here on Democratic Perspective we, you know, week after week try to track and describe in so many ways the insane tweets and the distraction that they supply, and that the stealth, that the plan is to get 38 states together and change the whole deal that becomes that screws up the separation of churches.
When's she talking?
Yeah, actually 34 states, and they already have 28
states.
Lined up.
The constitutional professor is correcting the idiot radio show. I want to say that the legal.
No, I think you got confused because 28 states have authorized.
Oh.
So it was probably that eight. Yeah, 28,
okay, 28.
Of the 34 needed for a constitutional convention, which of the likes we have never had since the Constitution was ratified. That's how radical it is.
Not only did she tell me why I was wrong, she told me why I was probably wrong.
She did it nicely.
She tried to make, yeah. You're an idiot
nicely.
Because eight, yeah.
No.
The League of Women Voters of the Greater Verde Valley, the League, many of whom have been on the show in that role and many other roles, the League of Women Voters of the Greater Verde Valley, which I'm a member, invites you to a special presentation and book signing by Nancy McLean, author of Democracy in Chains. It's going to happen on Saturday, September 22nd, 10:30 to noon. Saturday, September 22nd is not far away. It's going to be at the Sedona Public Library. There's going to be a book signing at the Literate Lizard, too. You want to check on that. I want to read this also. I'm going to read the fine print simply because I want to. Because she's won some awards that I admire. She's won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. She's was a finalist in the National Book Award. It's a lot of people, including the men in this room, believe this book is really important. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning. It's great to be with you.
We do think it's important, and you know, here in Sedona, our little town of 10,000 people that gets 4 or 5 million visitors every year to look at our beautiful scenery. We had an attack, much like you described, by a combination of Americans for Prosperity people and the Tea Party. Tea Party in Sedona became very unpopular. So by 2014, they changed their name to something innocuous like Concerned Citizens of Arizona and had this slogan. And the slogan was, it's amazing how much good you can do if you don't claim credit for it, which is euphemistic. Well,
wow.
You know what that means. And if we hide who we are, and we hide our agenda, our overall agenda, then we can convince people to do something. That's something you've written about as kind of the core of your understanding of how the radical light libertarian movement got going.
Yeah, the subtitle of my book includes the phrase stealth plan of the radical right, and, you know, there are many illustrations of that in the book. I mean, they include everything from this radical Charles Koch network-backed rights efforts to undermine Social Security by claiming to reform it, right? And in my book describes a multi-step plan that they began to work on in the 1980s for how to do that, which a plan that's accelerating now. It also includes things like promoting climate science denial, the myth of voter fraud, you know, all of these things that are basically systematic misinformation of the public in order to move this agenda, but also measures like suppressing the vote, the most radical gerrymander we've ever seen, undermining public sector labor unions without saying that that's actually what they're trying to do, and so forth. And in states like mine, you know, both of our states are controlled by this radicalized Republican Party, but my state, North Carolina, has just seen absolutely unprecedented malfeasance, I guess you could say, on the part of these Koch-backed legislators who do things, you know, like they pass major legislation with no hearings, with no opportunity for amendments. They do things in the middle of the night. They operate by secrecy. They do all kinds of things that break with traditional norms of good governance, and they really are moving by stealth and by secrecy and trying to do as much as possible out of the public eye and without being honest with the people about, you know, what their end goals are. So I am not surprised that you are confronting this in Arizona, where you have such an important outpost of the Koch project in the Goldwater Institute, in two campus Koch-backed centers at Arizona State University and the University of Arizona, and with a governor, Doug Ducey, who is a regular attendee at these Koch donor summits that engage radical right billionaires and multimillionaires who are trying to use dark money to transform our government.
I said Governor Ducey, governor of Arizona, almost a pure Koch brothers puppet,
yes.
in unapologetic for it. I want to.
Oh, and by the way, one more thing, and I hate to front load all this, but I'm sure we can pick apart different pieces
ahead.
As we go. You also have on your Supreme Court, which I know Governor Ducey expanded in a way that many people perceive to be illegitimate. One of your Supreme Court justices is a man named Clint Bolick, who has been a Koch grantee since the 1970s with a radical vision of transforming our Constitution back to a pre-New Deal Constitution, and we might get into, you know, some of what that looks like. But he's actually written a book in which he says it's easier to change state constitutions than the federal constitution, and many states now, including my own North Carolina, are operating on that counsel and pushing constitutional amendments, again, in a way that misleads the public in order to achieve this radical right program.
So we're looking at all these various things you're talking about they're trying to do. What's the core? What's the core theory? What's the core method behind all these disparate tactics and programs? Why come into our little town of Sedona, 10,000 people, have a campaign led that will cripple our city government by somebody who doesn't even live in Sedona?
Yes, I'm so glad that you asked that, because I think, you know, for many of us now, you know, we've been experiencing a kind of the shock and awe doctrine of warfare in our domestic politics for almost a decade now, and people are a little dazed. So I think your question about going to the core of this is really crucial, because otherwise it feels like we're playing whack-a-mole in a way that can get exhausting.
Exactly.
So that what I believe to be the absolute most important finding of my research for the book is that I saw the architects of this cause, Charles Koch and a particular Nobel Prize winning economist whose ideas they have, the donor network and the organizations have weaponized, saying again and again that they recognized that their ideas were unpopular. Right? That they were a permanent minority. And because they are a permanent minority, because most of us don't want to live in a world without Social Security or Medicare or public schools or, you know, government protection of our clean air and water and so forth, because most of us would be horrified if we knew that is actually the end goal, they are operating by stealth. And what they're doing is systematically going around and engaging in radical rules change, right? Pushing the existing rules to the brink in order to get what they want. Things like Ducey, you know, expanding the Supreme Court would be, you know, a case of that. Privatizing schools as much as they can with vouchers, another example. But so they keep radically changing the rules, but ultimately moving towards this effort to rewrite our constitutions in a way that would permanently entrench the power of the wealthiest, most right-wing minority that doesn't believe it owes anything to the people, to the, you know, to their fellow citizens, to the commons. So that is the end game, is radical rules change culminating in constitutional change, radical constitutional change, in order to entrench the power of a minority over the vast majority.
These guys hate America. I mean, we're talking Charles Koch, the Rowleys, they obviously Buchanan, some of the people that have passed, but the Cato Institute, they hate America. They hate the America that exists, and they want to change it so deeply.
Yeah, I think that's fair, Max. They hate the America that exists,
yeah,
and the institutions, but they believe that they love America.
Steve's always afraid that I'm going to say something radical, which I do, and I try to. But seriously, they hate America, and they want to change it so deeply. Mm-hmm. To something that we would not recognize, as Nancy McClain, good morning, has just said, that we don't want to, most Americans don't want to live in a country without Social Security. We don't want to live without Medicare. We don't want to live in a climate and a science denying environment. I saw Han Solo on the TV the other day saying, stop electing politicians that don't believe in science. For God's sakes,
stop
doing that. But I want to underscore some of this, because what happens as a result mm-hmm. of this is there's nobody to speak for the worker. There's, you know, when you create the oligarchy, when you create rule by an elite rich, there's nobody to speak for the worker. So we wonder why people working 2, 3, 4 jobs and the homeless on Wilshire Boulevard are multiplying. Homeless in the hills of the Verde Valley are multiplying. The climate science denial is suicidal. I mean, it seems for the profit of a few, we're denying the science that will save hundreds of millions. Like you said, it is the whack-a-mole thing. It's hard to wrap your mind around a movement that wants to profit a few in the fossil fuel industry
The thing, Nancy, is out here in Arizona, and what Mike's talking about is we see the results. We see the fingers, but we don't see the hand behind them.
Nicely put.
What is the history of this movement? Because we see it everywhere. Ducey, Supreme Court just threw off our dirty money petition that had hundreds mm-hmm. of thousands of signatures based on the most bizarre things you can imagine. So mm-hmm. what is the hand? What is the arm? What is behind what we see?
That's really the story that my book tells. So I think many of your listeners may be familiar with the work of, you know, some of our, you know, best investigative journalists like Jane Mayer, who wrote the book Dark Money.
Right.
So they have followed the money trail in an important way. I happen through other research to get on the trail of the ideas that the Koch network has weaponized. And they go back to the 1950s to the White South's resistance to Brown versus Board of Education. In that context, a man named James McGill Buchanan came to Virginia and began to develop this new school of thought that it has been weaponized by the Kochs. But to make a long story short, he, Buchanan, and Charles Koch got to know each other at least as early as 1970. Buchanan collaborated on building up all these Koch-backed institutions like the Cato Institute, the Heritage Foundation later, the Federalist Society, you know, and so forth and so on, many, many others. But what Koch himself said is Koch has been investing since the 1960s in funding originally hundreds, then thousands, ultimately, of intellectuals. He said he was looking for the technology, right? The right technology to break through, because Charles Koch is a very smart man, and he understands that his ideas are unpopular, that, again, we don't want to live in this world. So how is he going to get around that obstacle in a democracy? So he was funding all these intellectuals to find these ideas. By the late 1990s, he settled on Buchanan's ideas as the ideas that could enable the breakthrough, and they began converting and building up this huge infrastructure that now includes hundreds of organizations, you know, including the Gold Warrior Institute, the ones I mentioned in D.C. There's actually international affiliates, et cetera, to move through this program. But here's the kicker, and I think this is really important for listeners to take in. We are in a kind of hyper-partisan environment, right, where the media always tells us that everything is Democrats versus Republicans, liberals versus conservatives. I frankly don't believe those labels even capture where we are, because first of all, the Republican Party that my dad voted for until his death in 2000, that party no longer exists, right? It's been taken over and bent to the will of the Koch donor network, and we saw that with the health care bills last year that were terribly unpopular, even with Republican voters, right, with everybody. And yet the Senate Republicans were pushing those bills through. So everywhere, you know, we could go on all of these things, but basically what I'm getting at is that this donor network has made it so the Republican Party elected officials are doing things that even Republican voters don't want, right? I mean, actually, most Republicans, and I hope you have some Republicans, oh dear, sorry, among your listeners, most Republicans actually believe we should be doing things about, you know, believe that there is climate change and that we should be acting on it, believe that our schools need more support, believe that our tax system is unfair and the wealthy aren't carrying their fair share, you know, believe that people should have, workers should have the right to organize. So this is not a division between, you know, sort of right up and down the line on the Republican versus Democrat. This is a radical right minority that has camouflaged itself as conservative in order to engage in a radical transformation of our society to the point where I tell people I'm a conservative, right? I mean, I'm really, you know, more of a progressive type, but sure. In a way, I feel like I'm a conservative because I am trying to conserve the popular democratic achievements of more than a century of American history.
That's it. That's what made this country the envy of the world,
exactly.
A liberal democracy, Republican or Democrat, they both governed a liberal democracy that everybody wanted to be a part of. I often use Jane Mayer and Nancy McLean in the same sentence. I believe these books are compatible in, if you want to understand what's going on. And you have this whole Charles Koch, the stern father, Rumi called it, you know, that wants to slap his students into submission. Mm-hmm. It seems, not, you know, one, a colleague of yours, Alan Wold from Boston University years ago, mm-hmm. he talked about what a genteel system we have. And these guys realized we have this, we don't have this European, this slash and burn, as you called it, mm-hmm. The shock and awe, as you called it, works here because we do have this sort of kind of nice little genteel system that requires compromise. No matter what school you went to, you remember all about all those compromises that went into creating the United States of America.
I want to go back to your book, which is not as well known, on modern Ku Klux Klan. And mm-hmm. I think that I see if you see a similarity. You talk about how that Klan expanded to 5,000 white male.
5 million.
5 million, sorry.
Yeah.
White, and it did so by not burning crosses and stuff, but by having meetings where they talked about promiscuity and mm-hmm. have family, and they spread it through innocuous barbecues and hot mm-hmm. dog events, and they managed to spread it while they were interiorly, it was the Ku Klux Klan. But I think as individuals, if you were an individual, you wouldn't see the whole thing that was the Klan was behind. Right.
Yeah, you'd see the tip of the iceberg unless you were really deep in. Yeah.
Is that sort of similar to what the Koch brothers and stuff are doing?
That's an interesting and important analogy. Yeah. I think, you know, I had not thought about the two topics in quite that way, but I do think that is a very appropriate analogy because it's, I don't think that the Koch, first of all, we know the Koch network is not honest with the Tea Party, rank and file Tea Party people that it's using as a battering ram to achieve its ends. And here's a really obvious example of that. There's a great book about the Tea Party by two brilliant sociologists who went out and interviewed as many it's very empathetic work, right? As many grassroots Tea Party members and leaders as they could, deep interviews. They went to meetings. They talked to people. They did, anyway, really, really systematic study. They could not find a single grassroots member of the Tea Party or leader who wanted to see the privatization of Social Security and Medicare, right? But that is exactly, as they show, what the Koch donor network, they called them roving billionaires, what the roving billionaires harnessed the Tea Party to do. So that is what upsets me so much, you know, not just as a scholar, but as a citizen, that this cause is so cynical and so dishonest with its own people about how it's using their energies. So in that sense, I think you're really right that it is very similar in some senses to that those dynamics in the Ku Klux Klan, where you would have within the Klan, you know, and again, different methods and stuff, but the Klan would have these, I forget exactly what they called them, I did that book in like 1994, but basically like these whipping brigades, right, these flogging brigades, and the people who would carry out the violence and the intimidation and so forth, that was a small kind of inner network of the Klan, whereas some of the ministers that they were using to get credibility might not know about that, right?
Yeah, we're not saying that the Koch brothers are the
Ku Klux Klan. So what you see now in the Koch network is a similar thing where, you know, I don't know because I'm not, you know, in their organizations and stuff, but I don't think that they're honest not only with the voters that they need, but with the people that they're recruiting into the lower levels of their organization. And so actually, if your listeners were to Google me or my book, they'll find all this trash talk about me by the Koch network operatives and Koch-funded academics who don't declare their, you know, that they're financially dependent.
They don't like you, Nancy.
We were talking about that before the show. Yeah, we were talking about that before the show.
A year later, yes. They still don't like you any more than they didn't like you last year.
No, but the point being, I think that those guys are terrified that the people they're recruiting to this cause will read my book, right?
Absolutely.
Because then they'll understand what they're being used to do and what this is really all about and who it's serving. And so that's why I think they've come at me so, you know, in such a sustained, relentless kind of manner, because they don't want people to know, and especially I think they don't want their own people to know.
Well, as I said, your book makes those connections that they don't want them to make. As you said, they want to use them for their own purposes. They're lying even to the people that are doing the work for them. And we have, I have to say this, and I know this is a kind of a knee-jerk thing, but we have seen this before. We have seen leaders through their power of their money lead people in a fooling them down the road. I mean, whether you know it's, you want to quote Abraham Lincoln, whether you want to quote Franklin Roosevelt, whether you want to quote anybody that's watched the 1930s and that gentleman dictator from Germany. All of these things, we have seen this before, and we are seeing it again.
I think even
way deep. It's a messianic movement. You know, I'm not with, there are some people who today throw around the label fascism loosely, and I don't think that the Koch project is fascist, but I think where it does connect in what you're saying is that it is absolutely messianic. I mean, Charles Koch has compared himself to Martin Luther of the Protestant Reformation, and he, in 1997, when this was, you know, when he was really getting serious about building up this operation and weaponizing Buchanan's ideas and using George Mason University as a base camp for all this, he said, and this is a quote, "I want to unleash the kind of force that propelled Columbus to his discoveries." Okay, that is a messianic vision, right? And we know from all these other things, whether it's like the Crusades or fascism or communism or whatever, as you say, we've seen this movie before with that kind of messianic vision where nothing in the world conforms to the vision. So the idea is you have to smash everything, destroy people's capacity to resist in order to realize the true utopia. And as you say, we've seen that vision before, and it does not end in a pretty way. And
well, that's
it takes,
so
untold
saying,
damage.
The motivation is to get to some sort of utopian that they envision. It's a little hard to see how, you know, old people dying and kids going hungry and lack of it. It's hard to see how that gets to utopia. So why?
I can tell you, so the utopia is also, in their vision, the society of perfect economic liberty in which each one of us is responsible for all of our own needs from cradle to grave. These people believe, you know, and they say in their writings, they, you know, they don't try to say this like openly to the public, right, but they believe there are only three legitimate roles for government: to provide for the national defense, to ensure the rule of law, and to guarantee social order. As one radio interviewer summarized that to me, armies, courts, and police, right? Beyond that, they believe government is not legitimate. It is not legitimate to tax, you know, as your referendum tried to do in Arizona, to tax the wealthiest who are benefiting most from the system as it exists in order to make sure there's opportunity for others. That's not legitimate to a hard libertarian like Charles Koch or the people he funds. So, I mean, that's what we're looking at, is that, so their dream vision is that, supposedly we will go through this period of bitter adjustment where, as you say,
people will die,
right, because their needs won't be met. And then supposedly at the end of that, we're all going to come out and be, you know, converted to pure responsibility to providing for all of our needs. And this is the kicker. They want us to provide for our own needs with individual accounts, right, individual retirement accounts instead of Social Security, individual unemployment insurance accounts, individual accounts for our kids' private schooling. Where would those accounts be invested? With an unregulated financial sector.
Why do they want this?
Like, it is just, create the most unsustainable society that you know, even science fiction writers, I think, cannot imagine.
Why do they want to destroy the government so much? Why do they want to weaken government? Why is that central to what they're doing?
Well, we're talking about not only weakening government, but changing the Constitution. I said something, there's a phrase in the preamble, which we all learned, hopefully, at least some, you know, promote the general welfare. And I had a gentleman the other day that heard the word welfare and insisted that the word welfare was not in the Constitution anyway.
Wow. Wow.
I have a copy of the Constitution
it's there. And whether you want to believe it's there or not, it's there. So
why the attack on government? Why do they hate government so much? Why do they want, what happens if you really weaken government's ability to do anything but wage war?
Well, again, you know, we're talking about zealots here, right? And people with this messianic vision. So they all, you know, there's probably a different origin story for a lot of them. But one thing I will say is that, you know, we can observe that this is a cause that is overwhelmingly white. Overwhelmingly, there are hardly any people of color in the libertarian cause, even though they try desperately to recruit people. As one African American journalist I was talking to said, you know, they tried to recruit him at one point, and he said, "Why?" He said, "My house is on fire. Why would I want to add gasoline?" But, you know, in other words, this would just make everything much worse than it is. But anyway, so overwhelmingly white. And also, I think, you know, I'm married to a wonderful man. I know lots of wonderful white men, so this is not a thing against white men. But also, it is overwhelmingly a male cause. And I think these are, in a certain sense, a lot of men who just grew up accustomed to privilege. Many of them seem to, seem to have trouble with other people, you know, or accommodating other people in that way we were talking about, with compromise and recognizing another's point of view and empathy and all these kinds of things. And they just seem to imagine that they have this, that they're going to come out on top in a system like this, and that is their just desserts, right? That they should come out on top. And so I've read, you know, autobiographical writings of some of these guys. You know, these are the guys that, as like young people, they love Ayn Rand, you know?
Yeah.
And that kind of world. And, you know, frankly, to me, it just seems sort of sophomoric, you know, it's like,
yes,
grow up. That is appealing to them. And I will say this too, that the libertarian cause today, is not overtly racialized, but I do think that part of the reason this cause is so white and has so much trouble recruiting African Americans or Latinos or others is because they romanticize a vision of society and government when white men were dominant and other people were not, their citizenship was not accepted, you know, it was not respected, their dignity was not respected, they were excluded from the law. Like James Buchanan, the person I wrote about, he said his ideal constitutional order was that of 1900. you know, you think of that, 1900, workers had no right to organize together for collective voice. There was mass voter suppression. It was a terrible time for most people. Women couldn't vote, but that is the period that he would look back to as the ideal, and that is the kind of legal and constitutional system the Koch network people are trying to bring us.
Supreme Court nominee
Brett Kavanaugh, he's in that model.
The first libertarians I met, Nancy, back in the 60s and 70s in college, were brilliant young guys who were deeply isolated from society, that didn't feel a connection to other people.
Yeah.
They were a very smart group, but their policies to me seemed very cruel, but to them they seemed a way of cleaning out a stable that had gotten messed up. But that was it. What I noticed about them was the feeling that they were not part of a country or a society, and therefore they wanted to establish rules that benefited them as private individuals, which, as you explained, that they believed would in the end end in a society that helped everybody.
So how can we get to some solutions that we've kind of talked about? We're laying out the problem, as your book does so very well. I had one woman tell me, based on this show, by the way, she started the book, and she said, it was too scary. I couldn't finish it.
Well, if they think the book is too scary, you got to think about the world it's bringing into being.
We can put
our heads in the sand, or we can face this thing.
There you go. So let's talk about some solutions. Now, you mentioned it briefly just now. Women. These guys want to go back to a time before women could vote. Women are voting, whether they like it or not. And we're, at least in Arizona, we're talking about six of our nine political offices, I believe, are being on the Democratic side. We have women.
They want women to vote. They just don't want women to vote as women.
So is the solution going to be women in government, women in, certainly in the electorate, or do we need our own billionaires, the Tom Strayers? He started NextGen. This is where his...
Yeah, I think, well, I will say it's interesting. I mean, because the book is, you know, it does present a rather stark vision, but I will say also for people who finish the book, I have heard, I mean, I get, you know, I don't know, hundreds of letters from people and, you know, meet people at the public talks I've done all around the country and stuff, and people are finding this message really empowering because they feel like now they understand what they're dealing with when they hear, you know, listen to the news, they're, you know, viewing it through a different lens, they have a sense of their own efficacy after they get this, as opposed to just feeling overwhelmed in that shock and awe way. So I encourage people to finish the book because I do think that they will feel empowered by the knowledge they get. But I will also say that, like, independently of that, I am really actually encouraged by what I'm seeing around the country, in that Americans are really starting to get that we are at an emergency moment for democracy, right? That it is an all-hands-on-deck moment for the defense of our democracy, and people are responding to that in different ways. There are, as you say, you know, there's all these new people running for office, ironically, since Donald Trump was elected, where he's really mobilized, you know, people and fixed their attention on the need for good government. But so, as you say, there's lots of new people in the pipeline. There are groups like Individual. There's the teachers' mobilization, you know, in the Red for Ed teachers' mobilization that happened in your state and mine and many other Republican-dominated ones, which is really exciting. You know, the Parkland students saying we have to use our democracy to get common sense gun reform, not to outlaw guns as the NRA makes it, but to have common sense rules like we do for driving, right? But there's all these efforts going on that I think are really encouraging. I think ultimately, in order to defeat this Koch network, we are going to have to hold Democrats as well as Republicans accountable to a series of pro-democracy reforms and treat those as must-have, right? Things like independent redistricting, so that to stop this gerrymandering, to keep, you know, minority parties in power, because, you know, letting elected officials choose their voters rather than vice versa. So independent redistricting, automatic voter registration, dealing with money in politics. You know, there are many, many ways in which we can deal with the chronic problems that have developed in our democracy that brought us to this acute crisis of the Koch network having the power that it has, and Donald Trump being in the White House And I should say there, too, Charles Koch actually has boasted at recent donor summits. He said at one, we have achieved more in the last 5 years than I was able to achieve in the previous 50. And in another one, he said, we have achieved more, these are both last year, in the last year than in the previous 10. So they are sailing through under the Trump administration, circling back to how you opened the show today. You know, Donald Trump is the distractor in chief. You know, every day is a storm. Every day is a tumult with him doing some outrageous thing that fixes everybody's attention while the Koch program goes through every federal department and agency and the 30 states they now dominate. So the threat is there. The challenge is there, but I do believe if we can alert as many Americans as possible to what is happening and encourage people to become politically active, to vote in these midterms, to engage in their communities, we can not only defeat this, but also renew our democracy in the ways it needs to. It desperately needs to be renewed for the challenges of the 21st century.
Okay, good question. Did Donald Trump or someone working for him write the anonymous letters to the New York Times?
I have no idea. You know, you're asking, like, I'm a historian, right? I have to have an evidentiary base. I don't have the evidence for that. But you know, I will say that it is really chilling, you know, that whoever wrote that letter, that the Republican Party at this point, because of that donor dominance over the party, it is so compromised that they would actually have people inside an administration, that they would have allowed the election of this figure who is incapable of understanding the elementary information he needs to perform as president, that they would have enabled that administration, and then they're going behind his back taking papers from his desk because they're afraid he's going to cause a world war.
Well, that's it.
But the thing, it is so cynical. So they are getting that 90%, whoever wrote that letter said, you know, we're getting our pro-prosperity tax cuts and whatever else they referred to. But, you know, they're willing to go to abide this in order to get what they otherwise could not from a healthy functioning democracy and a president who understood what was going on. It is, for me as a historian, I just, you know, the word that keeps coming up for everybody is unprecedented, you know, for what we're facing now. This is not normal. This is crazy. It's unlike anything that's gone on in our previous history. And the really sad thing is that the only elected Republican officials who are talking about it are the ones who are leaving office. Right. Who aren't
our own
facing
Jeff
the voters
Flake.
Anymore. I think our journalists have really let us down on that front, too, because
absolutely.
They should be interviewing these Republicans who are leaving in droves and say, what did you see? What happened to your party? How did this Koch donor network get the control it has, and how has it worked with the radicalized Republican base that is following Trump to create this kind of pincers action on Republican elected officials so that they're afraid of the donors and afraid of the frenzy that the organizations funded by those donors have cooked up among the electorate? And I can say this because I'm on their mailing list. I know what they send out. You know, the Republican base is not coming to these ideas on their own. They are constantly being jacked up by the right-wing media and by the organizations that are funded by the Koch donor network.
I think that's absolutely true. Do you have examples where the Republican, the moderate, the rank and file want one thing, but the donor network wants something else? Do you have an example of how that works, where if they were following their own, I guess, supporters, a feeling? I'll tell you this.
Sure,
pre-existing
conditions on health care. I mean, this is popular across the spectrum. Nobody believes that if you have cancer, you shouldn't be able to get health care, right? You know, or if you have diabetes or you have, you know, some other chronic disease. That was our situation prior to the Affordable Care Act, which they called Obamacare to, you know, create hostility to it, you know, because it's coming from a black president. But and having children on their parents' health insurance, right, you know, in their early 20s, these things are popular across the spectrum. But the Republicans in the Senate in particular work to kill the Affordable Care Act very aggressively. So if you remember back last year, and it's hard to remember because so much craziness is transpiring all the time.
We're off
people,
talking about
but they
Trump
had three
and
health care bills that were terribly unpopular. Not a single one polled above 18% support with the population, and not a single one had majority support in any state in the country. And yet the Republican elected officials in the U.S. Senate were pushing very hard to get those through. Now, John McCain, to his credit from Arizona, was part of not allowing them to rush through those unpopular bills. But that, I think, is a classic example of how they are pushing the donor agenda, not the people's agenda. And they actually boast about that at their donor summits. I have a quote in the book where one of them talks about how they use these dark money-funded primary challenges from the right plus dark money, you know, gifts to compliant elected officials as what they call their accountability play. And this one Koch official said, this accountability play is our secret sauce, so to speak. I mean, it's grotesque, right? This is supposed to be a democracy. One person, one vote. But instead, they have manipulated the rules in order to make sure that this arch-right network of extremely wealthy donors is skewing our politics so that they reflect the donor concerns and not the people's concerns.
The donor agenda doesn't create a working democracy. And so I think,
oh, it destroys it. Look what we're seeing. Yeah.
Well, it is. It's a Democratic perspective. And guest this morning, Nancy McLean, are telling people that we don't have in the USA today a healthy, functioning democracy. I do want to mention we don't have a lot of time left. I want to make sure I get this in, so let me start a little early, that you will be in town. Nancy McLean, author of Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. Democracy in Chains is the title. She will be in town here September 22nd. She'll be at the Sedona Library. Sedona Public Library at the 3250 White Bear Road right here in Sedona. She'll be there at 10:30 a.m. She'll be giving a wonderful talk.
She's a great speaker.
She's a great speaker.
Time.
No matter how much, you've heard it here on the show, folks, no matter how many times we try to screw her up, she has her message and it's organized and she gets it through even our insanity. So she'll be here on Saturday coming soon. She'll also be at the Literate Lizard doing some book signing there. So please turn out. I know I will. I want to give the title of her presentation, and obviously she's going to talk about her book, but she's refining it a little bit, how the Koch brothers and the radical right are plotting to change our Constitution while Americans are distracted by Trump tweets.
It's a particularly good lecture that I heard last time, Nancy, because you give an exciting but very systematic history of how all this happened. And we were in a room, I think, with the library, and nobody left. Everybody paid attention. It was you went into not scholarly detail, but near scholarly detail, and people listened. And you had a story of how things happened that they hadn't understood. I hope folks will come and hear you talking. I hope they'll read your book, which is, of course, available from all the bookstores. Literate Lizard's also available, of course, online.
Democratic Perspective has brought you Nancy McLean somewhat. And Jeff Biggers, a colleague of yours, has been here at the Sedona Library and talking about his books. And also, in stellar of scary, although informative. Let's stay away from the word scary, but they are so informative and have such a perspective, I think, is the what I want to emphasize here.
I'm the moderate guy on the program, and I think American democracy is in danger from this.
As a U.S. historian, I absolutely believe it's in danger. And you know, that's not just us three saying that. This is emerging as a consensus now, where you know our leading political scientists, economists, you know, sociologists, people who look at these things, people are saying, you know, trying to shout out to the public and say, hey, this is not normal. We have reached a crisis point. We have got to be focusing. We've got to not do anything stupid, right? But really start paying attention and get active and get organized. So absolutely. Actually, you know, I'm remembering that you guys brought me to Arizona last year too, because I spoke with you at some point. I forget quite when it was, but then you kind of organized a bit of a tour, and then I came through last year. And then I don't know how wide the catchment of your show is, but when I come out later this week, I'll also be speaking in Flagstaff and in Phoenix and in Tucson, as well as Sedona. So if there's people who happen to be listening there or know others who are there, they can get the information with that. That's being organized by AZ Blue 2020. You know, people are coordinating it from there. So
yeah, we are proud to have actually been the people who brought you to Arizona the first time, and we salute organizations like the League of Women Voters that's having a thing. We're pretty much out of time, Mike. Do we have announcements?
Sure. We want to salute AZ Blue 2020 for bringing her to the population centers where people actually live. We want to remind people that Democratic Perspective is on. You can find this podcast in a couple days. You'll find it at bvid.org. You'll find this show at Verde Valley Independent Democrats.org. You can find it at tunein.com. Very often they archive our shows. You can listen to Chasm live stream. You can listen at 780 AM live all over the world. Thanks, Nancy. See you soon.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZN. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.